It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The accusations are explosive that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration intentionally manipulated data to hide a 12-year pause in global warming, and that the flawed study was a major influence in the 2015 Paris Climate Summit, where Western nations agreed to spend billions to reduce fossil fuel use. That, according to John Bates, who recently retired as a lead scientist of NOAA's National Climatic Data Center. His claim took center stage at a House hearing today entitled Making the EPA Great Again.
We have every reason to be skeptical that our scientific community is maintaining its integrity.
In an exclusive interview Sunday with the Daily Mail, NOAA whistleblower Bates said, quote, they had good data from buoys and they threw it out and corrected it by using the bad data from ships. You never change good data to agree with the bad, but that's what they did, so as to make it look as if the sea was warmer. In a blog post, Bates skewered the study's author, Tom Carl, that he, quote, constantly had his thumb on the scale in the documentation, scientific choices, and release of data sets, all to discredit the notion of a global warming hiatus. The CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science today defended the NOAA study and said that Bates' whistleblowing is overblown.
All he is doing, quote, is calling out a former colleague for not properly following agency standards. This is not the making of a big scandal. This is an internal dispute between two factions within an agency.
In a statement, NOAA said, quote, it stands behind its world-class scientists, but takes the allegations seriously and, quote, will review the matter appropriately. Critics note climate research today is almost entirely funded by the government.
A number of scientists have come to me telling me that where before a certain time period they were receiving government research contracts, afterwards, after it became clear they didn't agree with the CO2 theory, no more contracts.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That was Doug McElway and his report on Fox just a week or so ago, but we didn't have a chance to talk about it, and we should, because people are claiming that all scientists, most of them, 90%, agree that the climate is changing. I think we all agree that the climate is changing, but that there is a global warming, that we are, the planet is getting warmer and that humans are causing it because of carbon emissions. You know the drill. And you know that it's a huge divide politically. The financial results of that can be devastating for countries. There are international treaties. This is a big industry. So we had, you know, a sort of a scandal a few years ago called ClimateGate. And it was where a scientist out of East Anglia in Europe, in England, leaked some email that were exchanged between scientists to show that they were tampering with the data. And that was a huge dust up. But somehow the climate change people managed to recover from that and regain their footing. But now another thing has broken. You just heard Doug McElway explain it. So is this a big deal or not? Well, I knew our next guest would know all about it, so I've asked him to join us. Dr. Cal Beisner is the founder and national spokesperson for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And if you don't know what that is, you should. It's a network of over 60 Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating for biblical earth stewardship. You know, we've talked about a great deal about the biblical view of immigration, rejecting really the leftist view of it. And I would say that Cornwall looks for God's view of stewarding the environment and the environmental, not the environmental movement, but the environment. And so Cal has founded this organization. I remember so well when it was founded. It has thrived under his leadership. And he joins us this morning. Hi, Cal. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Sandy. So great to be back with you again.
All right. So let's talk about what Doug McElway just reported. And this all came from a Daily Mail article in which this Dr. John Bates, who just retired, conveniently just retired, I might add, before he now accuses his co-worker, Thomas Carl, of falsifying information before the Paris Climate Summit. Okay, what do you know about this, and how can you talk to lay people about that? How can you make us understand what really happened?
Well, I suppose what I could say is what I know about it is that it's a minefield of opportunities for misunderstanding and getting yourself in trouble, frankly. The first news to break about this was, as you mentioned, in the Daily Mail, in an article by David Rose there, and he has, in fact, over the years, broken a number of really significant stories about how really solid empirical scientific data undercut the claim of dangerous man-made global warming. And so ordinarily, David Rose has been a quite credible source on that. And so then a whole bunch of other websites and media picked that up and made quite a big deal out of it. And for a while, it sounded like it was a scandal, possibly on the proportions of ClimateGate, although, frankly, ClimateGate involved literally thousands of emails back and forth among some of the major players in the climate alarmist camp, so to speak, that, you know, as I've read them, and I have read, indeed, the thousands of them, they show, I think, very clearly that these scientists were intentionally manipulating data, suppressing contrary data, blackballing scientists who didn't agree with them, corrupting the peer review process, and so on. ClimateGate was indeed a very big thing, and deservedly so. This one, I think, is going to turn out considerably smaller. The situation is basically this, that John Bates, who, as you mentioned, recently resigned from NOAA, his primary responsibility was overseeing data integrity at NOAA in terms of global temperature data, making sure that data were properly handled, that they were properly archived, that computer programs dealing with the data were properly documented, and so on. That's all very, very, very technical stuff. And what he actually said, and he published his comments himself on Judith Curry's blog, Climate Etc., at judithcurry.com. What Bates actually said was that Carl and his team failed to note when they submitted their article to Science magazine back in early 2015 that the data on which their conclusions rested had not yet been through the complete proper process of verification and archiving and so on required by NOAA. Had they said that, their article might have been greeted with more skepticism than it was. But Bates points out that he believes that there was considerable political pressure to get that article out quickly in order to influence negotiations that led to the Paris Treaty on Climate Change that was adopted in December of 2015. So, now, what Bates did not say is that, in fact, the data that Carl and his co-authors use did not support their conclusion. Their conclusion was, and I'm sorry, but all of this does get a little technical, their conclusion was that the apparent pause or hiatus in rising global average temperature that seemed to have gone from about early 1997 to the middle of 2015 or the end of 2014 at that point, that pause was not real, that better data, the data that they had for this article, showed that the warming had continued apace. Bates did not say that the real data underneath Carl's article didn't support that conclusion. What he said was that they hadn't properly handled and archived the data and had not informed Science magazine of that at the time. The real scandal is that political pressure was allowed to lead NOAA's team to publish results before those results were solidly based on the data handling techniques required by NOAA itself. That, I think, is the real scandal here.
You know, the one of the many, many allegations in this article in the Daily Mail is that, well, it's an allegation to me, that Thomas Carl, who was accused, hinted at by John Bates, that he was the data was not what it should have been, that supposedly showed that global warming was continuing, had a hotline to the White House through John Holdren. And John Holdren is a real strong climate change embracer,
yes.
And we know that the president embraces it. So we have there are evidences to suggest he might have been compelled to get to these conclusions before he was ready.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I mean, the Obama administration was just dead set on pushing through its policy of supporting the Paris Agreement and getting the United States involved in it. And so that seems pretty clearly to have happened. Now, though Bates didn't say that the data Carl and his co-authors used didn't properly support their conclusion that the pause in global warming was illusory, nonetheless, there are good reasons to think that, in fact, those data did not properly support that conclusion. And it's not because of how they went about archiving the data or anything else like that. It is instead because, in essence, Carl and his co-authors used data from less reliable sources and made those the basis for supposedly correcting data from more reliable sources. That's something that was pointed out back at the time that their article first appeared in 2015. As a matter of fact, I wrote about that at length on Cornwall Alliance's website in an article called NOAA Study Takes World by Storm, No Global Warming Pause. That, of course, was an ironic title because, as a matter of fact, the study didn't prove that at all. Eight other studies had shown exactly the same thing. And essentially what Carl and his co-authors said was not that there was no global warming pause. What they said was, our study of these data does not find the pause. Well, you know, gee whiz, I can find all sorts of different data that don't support the pause. I can make a study of the colors of the eyes of cats in my neighborhood, and then I can say these data do not support the global warming pause. Well, that'll be true, but it's totally irrelevant. Well, in this case, they studied particular data that were not particularly reliable, and they said, well, we don't find support for the pause here. The problem is, eight other studies of much more reliable data did, and that was more important.
And the further problem is that it was published right before the 2015 Paris Climate Change Conference, where 150 world leaders came, and Cameron, Prime Minister of England at the time, and also Prince Charles quoted this study, many of them, and you cited this study as the reason why they moved ahead with these sweeping decisions that have tremendous repercussions on their own countries, on their economies. And we want to talk about that a little bit, Calvin, because really, in spite of what the details are about this, this study, which some call Pause Buster, I guess that's the nickname for it, that claimed there was no pause in the warming, based on faulty data and incomplete research, caused the world, at least 150 of the leaders, to come to an agreement that has tremendous repercussions. We want to talk about that a little bit. And also, I'm curious to know what you think about the strength of the climate change movement is right now, if it's all smoke and mirrors or if they really have the power that they often seem to have. My guest is Cal Beisner. He's with Cornwall Alliance. And by the way, it's a great resource for information, videos, articles. It's a trusted source, Cornwall Alliance. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Over the past 6.5 years, we've taken on some of the toughest challenges of our time, from rebuilding our economy after a devastating recession to ending our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and bringing almost all of our troops home to strengthening our security through tough and principled diplomacy. But I am convinced that no challenge poses a greater threat to our future and future generations than a changing climate.
All right, so that was President Barack Obama. He consistently said that over and over. His policies reflected it, his leadership in the EPA, his willingness to support the Paris Climate Treaty. But now there's a new sheriff in town, and this is Donald Trump's position on the Paris Treaty.
President Obama entered the United States into the Paris Climate Accords unilaterally and without the permission of Congress. This agreement gives foreign bureaucrats control over how much our energy and how much we use right here in America. So foreign bureaucrats are going to be controlling what we're using and what we're doing on our land in our country. No way. No way. We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop all payments of the United States tax dollars to UN global warming programs.
All right, so that was Donald Trump, and that's how he stands on the matter. Couldn't be more different. My guest is Cal Beisner. He's the founder of the Cornwall Alliance. Cal, what was the Paris Treaty? I'm assuming, memory serves me, President Obama signed it, but the Senate did not ratify it. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
All right, so what is at stake? What's Trump upset about? What if we continued with the climate treaty out of Paris? What would that mean to us as a country?
Well, first, what it would mean to us is that we would see all prices of everything that we consume rise. And the reason for that is that the United States commitment under President Obama to the Paris Climate Agreement or treaty, I believe that it is properly a treaty and should have been submitted to the Senate, and because it wasn't, it isn't binding on the United States, but there are different arguments on that. At any rate, the United States commitment to it requires us to reduce our CO2 emissions, which will require us to switch from the most abundant, affordable, and reliable energy sources to less affordable, less reliable sources, like wind and solar, which will mean that the cost of producing everything rises. That will mean that the costs of everything made in America will rise, which means that consumers, both American and foreign, will buy fewer American goods, which will reduce employment. So we'll have a simultaneous increase in costs and decrease in income for Americans, which hurts everybody, but it hurts the poor most of all. And for that, what we supposedly get is a safer world in the future, protected from the dangers of man-made global warming. The problem with that is that even if all 195 nations that signed on to the Paris Agreement were to fulfill all of their you can't even call them commitments, they are individual nationally determined contributions, and there's no enforcement mechanism, but even if all of them were to do everything they said they want to do, the cost of doing that would be between $1 and $2 trillion per year, every year from 2030 to the year 2100, the end of the century. And the total reduction in global average temperature that would be achieved would be about 0.36 degrees Fahrenheit. That's too small to measure on a global basis, and it has absolutely no significant effect on any ecosystem, on any human economy, or anything else. So the whole thing is all pain, no gain whatsoever. This is why it makes no sense for the United States or any other nation to stay in the Paris Climate Agreement, unless, of course, you're one of those developing nations that recognizes that what the agreement is really all about is not controlling global temperature, but rather redistributing wealth from the developed world to the developing world. And that's exactly what a co-chairman of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said about 6 years ago, Otmar Edenhofer, a German economist, said, look, you must not confuse the climate talks with environment talks. This has nothing to do with the environment anymore. It's all about redistributing the world's wealth. We redistribute the world's wealth de facto through these climate negotiations.
Yes, we sure do. In fact, I know one of the proposals out of the climate treaty in Paris was that $100 billion would be given every year in extra climate-related aid to developing world by the so-called rich nations. So that's just out of pocket, the things we can see. And the other part of it, you know, Cal, you said no, all pain and no gain. Well, there is gain, I know you know this, for people like Al Gore who have invested in green energy and green products. There's a ton of money for the special ones.
That's true.
Yeah.
True. So what we do is we redistribute wealth away from pretty much all consumers, and we give it A, to developing countries, and B, to the owners of stocks and bonds in so-called green energy companies, low carbon dioxide emission energy systems, wind, solar, biofuels, although actually it turns out that biofuels put more CO2 into the air than natural gas, or geothermal. See, this is what's going on. There are major special interests involved here, and it really has ceased to be a matter about the environment. It's become a matter about lining people's pockets.
And Cal, the problem is that our children, and really children across the globe, certainly in European countries, are taught that this is a fact. It's like evolution. It's like the kind of science. Somehow we got into a cycle of believing science has replaced God and become, because it's supposedly factual, it's at odds with believing in God, when of course you and I know it isn't. But it does not comport with truth. It doesn't matter if it's true or not. It doesn't matter. It's what everybody thinks, so everybody has to think it. So do you see any signs of a softening of that hard line of propaganda in public schools or anywhere? Are we any moves to sort of to shake that up a little bit?
Well, I'm not seeing it in public schools. I'm not seeing it in the mainstream media. We certainly just saw it in terms of who won the last election. Was it a politician who said that global warming is the greatest threat facing humanity today? Or was it a politician who said that the idea of dangerous man-made global warming is wrong? And in fact, he went so far as to say it was all a hoax dreamt up by the Chinese government. Now, I disagree with him on that rather strongly. But you know, which one of those politicians got the trust of the American people in the election? That tells you where the American people are. And the great thing about this is that now we have people coming into office in this administration who are intelligent people, who are committed to open-mindedness, to even-handedness on these issues. For instance, Scott Pruitt, who's the Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, has been nominated to be the new federal EPA administrator. Pruitt is committed to sound science and to transparency in science. That is, he wants all government regulations to be based on science that is completely open to the public. And that'll be a new thing, because what the Obama administration did in the EPA, in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and in NASA, Goddard Institute for Space Studies, they used a whole lot of scientific conclusions that were based on research to which other scientists were not given access. And that meant that it couldn't be replicated, it couldn't be tested. President Trump supported the Secret Science Reform Act that has been introduced in Congress, and I think that's a great thing.
You know, with the not much has been said about Scott Pruitt. Initially, there was. Initially, I think the Green Movement, you know, had a stroke, but he sort of
apoplexy.
Apoplexy. Yes, they did. But you know, because of all the other things that are going on, there hasn't been much discussion, at least in the news, about this. But let's talk about what the repercussions of someone like a Scott Pruitt, who believes in accurate science, believes in truth, and administrating the EPA, what likely things might come from that, or if what we hope for comes to pass?
Well, I think, first of all, I should mention, by the way, that the Cornwall Alliance actually put out an open letter supporting Scott Pruitt's nomination to be the administrator of the EPA, and that got signatures by several hundred scientists and economists and other scholars, and then many more hundreds of ordinary lay people. So we were pleased with that, and in fact, in Scott Pruitt's confirmation hearing before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, Committee Chairman John Barrasso, senator from Montana, actually introduced our letter into the record and quoted from it and quoted from me. So we were really pleased with that. We had some impact there. Pruitt is first of all committed to the Constitution, and that means that he recognizes that we have a federal form of government where the federal government, the national government, is not supposed to do everything. A lot of things should stay at state and local levels, and so he is committed to devolving a whole lot of what the federal EPA has been doing back to the states, the counties, and the municipalities, which means that we're not stuck with a one-size-fits-all sort of solution. You know, an air pollution emission regulation that makes sense for, say, Detroit doesn't necessarily make sense for western Montana, where you have far fewer people and a totally different climate. So it makes sense to allow regulations to differ according to the parts of the country that are involved. He also firmly believes that the EPA needs to do proper cost-benefit analysis before it imposes a regulation. We need to know for sure that the costs of complying with a regulation will not exceed the benefits of complying with that regulation. If a regulation actually does more harm than good, we shouldn't adopt it. And so there is a point where we have to say, how clean is clean enough? And the answer to that is where the cost of getting cleaner exceeds the benefit of getting cleaner. So he believes in that. He also, by the way, is a strong Christian. In fact, he has been endorsed by a large number of leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention, of which he's a member, and he's strongly pro-life. And he is going to make sure that EPA regulations do not undercut human health and human life, which sometimes they have in fact done because they have driven people into poverty who were not otherwise going to be poor. And poverty itself has its costs in terms of high risks to health and to longevity.
Yeah.
So he's a great guy, and I think he'll be a superb EPA administrator. The Greens were very upset about him because he questions the magnitude and danger of human-induced global warming. But I think it's pretty clear that he's going to wind up being confirmed, and he'll do a good job.
You know, Cal, the other issue, of course, is I've watched, you know, the 8 years of the Obama administration. The EPA, I'm not sure, I would say criminalized so many of their regulations. People actually were fined beyond measure, beyond reason. Some people went to prison for just infraction. They didn't even know they'd broken the law, like changing the line of their property, moving things that belonged to them. The EPA took on a SWAT team. I remember the story about them going into a factory in, I believe, Kentucky that was producing some kind of wood, or not producing the wood, but using a certain kind of wood imported to make Gibson guitars. And they go in with a SWAT team and they arrest people. And then, honestly, it has been a nightmare under the Obama administration. I would think that Scott Pruitt might not be down with criminalizing people for things they do to violate regulations.
Yeah, that's certainly the case. And as a former attorney general, he's somebody who really does get the United States Constitution. He does recognize that it was put together by the people of the United States in order to ensure domestic tranquility. You don't get that by militarizing the EPA, by giving it vast numbers of SWAT teams and And having them go in and do, as you said, happened at that Gibson guitar factory in Kentucky, where because they were using wood from a particular kind of tree in India that the U.S. counts as endangered species, but the Indian government doesn't, so it's not illegal to import that from India. Well, the EPA went in and literally stormed the place. I mean, that's just absurd. So Pruitt was not going to allow that kind of thing to continue.
So there was a new sheriff in town, and there will be repercussions and changes, God willing. All right, my guest is Cal Beisner, and again, he's with the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, which is just a wonderful concept. And we've talked to Cal about this before. Maybe we'll touch on that when we return, too. But he's just written a new article on carbon tax, so we'll talk about that next. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Oklahoma's top prosecutor Scott Pruitt will be named as the new director of the EPA, according to Reuters.
This is not just about the oil and gas business. This is about every person that's trying to conduct business in the U.S.
For years, Pruitt and Oklahoma sued the agency, arguing it overreached when it came to regulating factory and power plant emissions. Oklahoma Independent Petroleum Association Chairman Jeffrey McDougall sees Pruitt cutting back regulations to generate Oklahoma and the country's economy.
And over the 8 years that Obama has been in, we've had over 600. Now, any industry that has to deal with that onslaught is just difficult to get past it.
But some environmental groups, like the World Resources Institute, says the pick raises deeply troubling questions, saying Pruitt has been an outspoken critic of rules that protect water and air and has led efforts to prevent EPA from reducing greenhouse gas emissions and other pollutants.
All right, so that's a little more of an expanded view. That's when Scott Pruitt was first chosen. And so I just thought you'd like to know a little background on him. He'll be the new head of the EPA. And that's really good news. I mean, I can tell you businesses, small businesses, medium-sized businesses around the country are thanking God for the nomination of Scott Pruitt. My guest is Calvin Beisner. He's the founder for Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. There are a lot of changes to come. Cal, I was just thinking two other practical things. And that is, the reversal on the Dakota Pipeline, moving ahead on the Keystone Pipeline, there are practical things that are going to change because of a competing, totally polar opposite view of the world, creation, and its resources from the President Obama to President Trump. But President Trump, of course, is really espousing, at least in part, the philosophy of Cornwall Alliance. And I remember when you guys founded, and I remember why. It was a response to the environmental left, which had gone out of control since the 70s. It wasn't in the 90s, but they were beginning to bring Christians into the movement, and it was becoming very confusing. What was the biblical view of the world? How shouldn't we be good stewards of the earth? Shouldn't we want clean water, clean air? And so Cornwall developed out of this. Tell people a little bit about that, Cal.
Well, you know, what we recognized was that a whole lot of Christians who had great motivations, I mean, we want to love God, we want to love our neighbors, right? I mean, these are the two great commandments. They summarize all of the law of Scripture. And so we want to show people love, and that means that we want to make sure that we take actions that minimize harm to people, that maximize benefit to people. And, you know, some environmental protection is very, very consistent with doing that. Obviously, you don't want to be spewing out poisons into the air and the water and the soil that are going to cause great harm to lots of people. The problem is that between the 1960s and 70s, when much of the environmental movement focused on real dangers from real pollutants, and made great accomplishments in the way of cleaning up our air and our waters and our soil. Between then and the 1990s and the early 2000s, much of the environmental movement instead began to focus on non-risks and really the pursuit of a sort of a worldview that says, look, human beings are basically consumers and polluters. We use up the Earth's resources and we poison the planet while we're at it. And so the best thing to do for the planet is to minimize human impact on it, to, for instance, pursue a small carbon footprint. And there became all sorts of different rationales for doing that, and frankly, the idea of dangerous man-made global warming is simply one of those rationales. What we recognized is that science and Christian faith were both being hijacked to a political agenda driven by an anti-human attitude. And so we wanted to bring together really outstanding scientists and really outstanding economists and really outstanding theologians, all of them committed to the Bible, to the Christian faith, to the Christian worldview, to provide an alternative to that kind of thinking, to help people think through these issues and come to policy understandings that really do result in our loving God and loving neighbor, and in our not embracing policies that on the surface may at first sound good, but turn out to be lacking in solid scientific and economic and ethical basis.
You know, I need to interject that because I talk about these things, meaning a lot of the issues that we face in the nation, a lot of the thoughts and the competing worldviews, it's not new that the left should target the evangelical movement and
not
try to co-opt some verses, some thoughts, and twist them slightly and use the ignorance, really, of the people of God's word to co-opt them into something that at the heart of it is really godless. You know, just the whole notion, Cal, that man has the ability to control, you know, weather and climate, that we could actually have some effect on it, I think is pretty audacious. I mean,
yeah, I think the idea that we're going to, you know, really set a thermostat and keep global average temperature within a certain range, that really is, I think, a bit audacious. But besides that, it simply goes way beyond what science itself would lead us to understand. The Earth's climate system is what's called a coupled nonlinear fluid dynamic chaotic system. All of those things together essentially mean this, and it's what was said by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change back in the 2001 assessment report. All of that means that, frankly, it is impossible, that's their word, impossible to predict future climate states. They don't even add accurately. They don't even add precisely. They just say it's impossible to predict them. That's because of the nature of the system. And what that tells me is that those who pursue trying to do that are pursuing an impossibility, and they're essentially challenging the sovereignty of God over these things. Now, I'm not saying by that, oh, we just simply sit back and do nothing about, say, for instance, chemical runoff from farms into streams causing problems, okay? Those are controllable. Global average temperature, global climate, no, we cannot control that. And frankly, we have no need to control it because climate risks essentially disappear almost. I mean, there's no such thing as a risk-free world, but climate risks are hugely reduced as people get richer and richer. We create property that protects us. And so if you get a hurricane in Miami today, you're going to have a huge amount of property damage, but very little in the way of human death or human injury, because that property protects the people. If you're extremely poor, you get a hurricane, a cyclone hitting Myanmar, for instance, there's very little property to protect the people, and so the cost in lives is enormous. Well, you know, we want the Cornwall Alliance to promote simultaneously biblical earth stewardship and economic development for the poor and that economic development for the poor will protect people from climate risks, and at the same time, it will give them the wealth they need to do proper protection of other aspects of the environment, because a clean, healthful, beautiful environment is a costly good, and wealthy people can afford more costly goods than poor people can.
Cal, we should say that Cornwall has really produced some great resources, because this is because we only get this from, like, say, you. There are a couple others, Joe Bast and a few others, but basically people are hearing all one way, and they know something's not right with this, but they can't articulate, because how could they? Their kids are not learning it at school. They're not seeing it on television. They're not reading it in newspapers. The whole idea of man-made control of climate and warming is sort of baked in the cake. So you're producing a new movie, as I understand, or a video at least, to explain some of this.
Yeah, we are. About a year and a half ago, we released a documentary called Where the Grass is Greener, Biblical Stewardship versus Climate Alarmism. That has been very well received, reviewed by quite a number of different climate scientists and the like. And that focused really on the science of climate change and a little bit on the economics of energy policy related to climate policy. Our new documentary that we expect to release in about the next couple of months, we haven't even titled it yet. In fact, your viewers could help us with that. We have a deal going where we're inviting people to suggest titles. They can go to our website, cornwallalliance.org, and take a look around. They'll see the invitation to help us title this new documentary. This new one is really going to focus on how climate policy is being promoted by environmentalists in the West. Would, if implemented, trap billions of people around the developing world in long-term poverty by depriving them of the abundant, affordable, reliable energy absolutely indispensable to lifting and keeping whole societies out of poverty. We've interviewed dozens of top world-class experts in this field and put those into this documentary. So I think this is going to be really helpful to a lot of people. We also have a series of videos already online called Greener on the Other Side. Those are on YouTube at Cornwall Alliance's channel there. And those address some of those same issues. But we have a new series that's going to be coming out, again, brief YouTube-length videos, that are interviews between our communications director and Mr. Vijay Jayaraj. He is an Indian environmental scientist, and he talks about why it is that the policies promoted in the U.S. and elsewhere in the developed world harm countries like his own India that are trying desperately to rise out of poverty, but their efforts are being frustrated by the kinds of policies being promoted by, for instance, the Paris Climate Treaty.
You know, I did not say, but I want to say that you are also a theologian. I first met you before you started, actually, the Cornwall,
yes.
And you were a professor. And so you know a lot about the biblical. You've thought a lot and prayed a lot, I'm sure, about what you've written for Cornwall and how you have founded the organization. So my question is this. Did we see any signs? Can we see any signs in Scripture that would have given us a hint as to where we would come with this godless, leftist, environmentalist movement? Were there any signs of that in Old Testament? Any hints of it? Do we see it? Was it pagan worship? What parallels do you see?
What a great question. And Sandy, you know what popped instantly into my mind is a point that I have made again and again in a variety of different places. For instance, in a lecture that I have actually on DVD with PowerPoint presentation incorporated right into it, called Godly Dominion versus Environmentalism. What I've pointed out is that, in essence, what the environmental movement has become, not what it started out to be, but what it has become, is an anti-human movement. And there is, I think, plenty of hint very early on in the Bible for exactly that. You know, Satan hates God. But God, of course, is infinite, eternal, and unchangeable. He is omniscient. He's omnipresent. He's omnipotent. you can't attack God. You know, God has already judged Satan and cast him out of heaven. You know, this is not a winnable war for Satan. But instead, Satan, who hates God, attacks God's image. We read in Genesis 1, 26 through 28, that God created man in his own image. He created man male and female, and he blessed them, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over everything in it. Well, if Satan wants to attack God, but he can't attack God directly, he attacks God's image instead, God's representative on earth, and that's human beings. And so he does that by undermining both our essence, that we are the image of God, male and female, and he does that through both the Darwinist movement in terms of evolution as the real origin of man instead of creation, and the sexual identity confusion movement, homosexuality, lesbianism, transgender, all of that, attacking the male and female aspect of the essence of humanity.
Oh, wow, Cal.
And then he attacks our mission, which is to fill and rule the earth.
Wow, that is, now there's another hour of conversation with you and me. We'll have to do that one the next time, but that's wonderful, Cal, and that's really kind of the perspective that I'm glad we're leaving our listeners with, because there is a God, and it does change our view of everything, and it is truth. It's not fanciful thinking. It is truth. Cal Beisner, Cornwall Alliance, cornwallalliance.org. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.